Our freedom of conscience and religion is being challenged by laws and regulations imposed by secular society. It's time to hear from the top Christian litigators in the nation who have come forward to tell us the truth and help us defend our faith.
Hear ye, hear ye. All rise. Faith on Trial with Defender of the Faith, Deacon Mike Mano, is in session.
Welcome to Faith on Trial, where we examine the influence of law and society on people of faith. I'm Deacon Mike Mano, your host, and I'm being joined now by Gina Noel, our co-host, who I'm sure has something profound to say. Gina?
Good morning.
How are you?
I am doing well.
Good.
I'm doing well. I see that today we've got quite a bit going on with the First Liberty Council.
Yes, we do. First Liberty has four cases that they were interested in that they think are going to set a trend for legal thought for the future.
Legal precedent.
Precedent. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. Thank you. Anyway.
Look at me. Legal speak right out of the number.
Hey, you're getting good. We're going to have you take the bar exam one of these days.
I don't know.
You're learning a lot from osmosis here. But anyway.
I'm learning a lot.
Anyway, we're going to talk about two of them. And I wanted to get all four of them on at one time. And things didn't work out right. So we have Stephanie Taub, who is first up, and she's going to be talking about religious liberty in the workplace. And then we're going to have Jordan Pratt, who will follow her, who is talking about regulations and laws and ordinances that single out churches and places of worship. And that's going to be kind of interesting because, as I understand it, the case comes up in terms of an ordinance that prohibits firearms in a church. Now, you might think, well, wait a second, why would you want to allow firearms in a church? Well, there's more in principle behind that. We're going to talk about that with him.
Yes, and I think that it's very important in terms of rights, you know, singling out religious institutions for laws that don't affect secular institutions is definitely not a democratic or right offered by our Constitution.
And that's exactly the point that they're making. So we'll talk to Jordan about that. And of course, the other thing that comes up as you look at that is that makes the church automatically a gun-free zone, which means that nobody in the church is supposed to have a weapon. So churches can't go out and hire, because there's been a lot of violence at churches and shootings at churches. A church can't go out and hire armed guards to protect itself and things like that. So it's going to be kind of interesting. It's kind of an interesting twist, and we generally don't think of churches as being places where people can carry concealed weapons, but we'll see. We'll talk about that.
We do not. It's something new that we haven't addressed.
Yeah,
two constitutional amendments kind of overlap here on our program.
That's right. That's right. It's a twist that we have not dealt with before. So we will see.
Yeah, and this week, so many things we could have covered. I saw that Melissa's Sweet Cakes by Melissa is headed to the Supreme Court again,
right.
And our friend
First Liberty.
Jack,
I think First Liberty is doing that too. Yeah, and Kennedy, yeah. The coach. That's all First Liberty.
Yeah, and our friend Jack from Colorado is being persecuted again for not making a cake.
Right, and I believe that's ADF. Right.
Transition.
Mm-hmm.
A gender.
He's already won once in the Supreme Court, and now they're going to go back and try and have
him again. What is going on in Colorado that they just keep coming after him?
Well, they have lax marijuana laws, I guess, and
that's related.
That may be it.
Might
I don't know.
It might be.
Might be.
I mean,
all right.
So a lot going on.
There's a lot we want to talk about at the end too. We want to talk about Mark Houck and his acquittal, which is a major step. And we're going to talk more about that at the end of the day. But to open up right now, do you have a prayer for us?
very necessary, a prayer for peace today. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. God of peace, bring your peace to our violent world, peace in the hearts of all men and women, and peace among the nations of this earth. Turn to your way of love those whose hearts and minds are consumed with hatred. Strengthen us all in hope, and give us the wisdom and courage to work tirelessly for a world where true peace and love reign around among the nations and in the hearts of all. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Gina, and we will be right back after these messages. You're listening to Faith on Trial on the Iowa Catholic Radio Network. And we're back. You're listening to Faith on Trial on Iowa Catholic Radio, and we're here with Stephanie Taub, who is a senior attorney with the First Liberty Law Firm. And Stephanie is representing an interesting case involving, or an interesting litigant, I suppose, a postal worker who was asked to work on Sunday. So, Stephanie, why don't you pick it up from there and give us the whole version of the case.
Absolutely. So the U.S. Supreme Court recently decided to take up this case, and it provides the court with an opportunity to really restore religious liberty in the workplace. And so this case is about Gerald, who is a mail carrier who strongly believes in observing the Sabbath. But more broadly than that, it represents an opportunity for the court to restore religious liberty protections for employees across the country. So federal law provides really robust protections for employees of faith in the workplace. But over the years, courts have watered down those protections. And so we're asking the Supreme Court to step in to clarify that the law really requires employers to provide meaningful religious accommodations for people of faith.
Now, the U.S. Postal Service is a big organization, and as I recall, there's a provision in the law that says the religious liberties of the employee have to be protected unless by doing so it would cause great harm to the employer or something to that effect. It seems to me with all the employers that the Postal Department has that there'd be plenty of people to go around. So let's go back and start where this case began. He had been working for the post office for some time, correct?
That's right. He was working for the post office for years, and he actually joined the post office in the first place because they were traditionally closed on Sundays. But then the post office started making Amazon deliveries on Sundays.
Okay.
And so Gerald, he tried to find a way to make this work. He was willing to work holidays that didn't fall on Sundays. He was willing to work extra shifts. He even switched posts one time in order to be able to observe the Lord's Day. But then the post office, it accommodated him for a time, and then they withdrew the accommodation. And you're absolutely right to point to the size of this organization. When we're talking about big government agencies, when we're talking about big employers, they are much more likely to be able to provide accommodations for people like Gerald who have these sincere religious beliefs.
All right, so what is the history of the case? When did this start, and what were the lower courts? Obviously, if you're going to the Supreme Court, you've been to a couple of lower courts before. How did they rule on this?
That's right. So we came up through the Third Circuit, and the Third Circuit, it ruled partially in Gerald's favor, but partially against him. It held that this was not an undue hardship for the post office, or that it was an undue hardship for the post office. Excuse me. Basically, saying that the post office didn't have to accommodate him, and that really shows what the real problem is here: is that this language, this undue hardship language, has been watered down by the courts over the years. And we're asking the court to really to restore that, because clearly this is a huge employer. We've offered several ways where they could have accommodated Gerald, but they just simply don't want to. They don't recognize that the law requires them to provide religious accommodations, and in the same way that it is required to accommodate the workplace needs of other employees. That's in a nutshell the history of the case. It came up through the Third Circuit. It's been percolating for years. And so now we're asking the Supreme Court to clarify this standard. And with a clear standard, it could help restore religious liberty in the workplace.
Now, is your client still working, or has he lost his job, or what's his personal situation?
Yeah, so he was facing progressive discipline over several months, and it just got increasingly more, and he was essentially one step away from getting fired. So this is he was essentially forced out of his job because he kept observing the Sabbath. He kept honoring his commitment to God to observe the Sabbath. And so now he's no longer with the Postal Service.
Okay, now I know there are a number of evangelical churches, especially the independent churches, that on Sunday it's almost like a whole day is devoted to religious worship. I take it that's where this all comes in, that he's dealing with something where he really wants to be where he's supposed to be in church.
So he is a non-denominational Christian who does believe that he needs to observe a Sunday the whole day as a day of rest.
Fine. Go ahead, Gina.
Many churches observe Sunday as a day of rest. There's plenty of employers that we're familiar with.
Tell my wife that when the lawn needs to be mowed, would you please?
That's a little different, Deacon Mike. I think I'll take her side on that. But there's a lot of organizations and retail operations that respect that day and allow their employees a day of rest for that very reason. So it's not unheard of or unusual. Is Mr. Groff looking for any kind of relief? Will he, because it's an employment situation that affected his income, will a win in the Supreme Court allow him some kind of financial relief?
Well, we're hopeful. We're asking for, he went through so much at his previous job, and so we're asking for various kinds of relief. But the real reason why he's pursuing this case is really to help protect other people in situations like him, to be able to honor their commitments to God, and be able to freely practice their religious exercise at work.
Now, we've seen over the past couple of years, I'm sorry, Gina, go ahead.
No, I'm just curious about this particular case in that the post office at one point did, early on, before they picked up Amazon as a delivery objective, they did honor his request to have Sundays off from work as a day of rest for religious reasons.
Yeah, so before they took on Amazon, no one was working on Sundays at the post office. And then when they took it on, they rolled it out gradually. And so he transferred first to a branch where they weren't doing Sunday transfers. And then that branch started doing Sunday transfers. And so then he tried to find employers who would cover his shifts, and he offered to work extra hours. And he's been trying so hard, but they put him through. They basically refusing to admit that they have an obligation to try to find a solution here. And so they just didn't end up accommodating him, even though they could have.
So there was no accommodation, not at any point. Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks
now,
for clarifying.
Now we know that that the law requires them to accommodate religious preferences, but only if it will won't create a hardship. How did the post office argue that one employee not working on Sunday to deliver Amazon packages was a hardship on them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it comes back to a case from the 70s called TWA v. Hardison. And that case, the Supreme Court at the time said that undue hardship was anything that was more than a de minimis burden on the company, which is basically saying that undue hardship means minimal hardship, which seems absolutely contradictory to the plain meaning of the text and contrary to Congress's intent, which is to say, no, undue hardship means a significant difficulty or expense. So Congress wanted to provide meaningful religious accommodations to people of faith. And so if you basically saying that you need to accommodate unless this would be a significant difficulty for your business. But because of this case from the 70s, courts have said, oh, well, we're going to impose these really lenient requirements on the employers, which is contrary to what Congress said, contrary to the text. And so we are asking, so the Supreme Court now has this opportunity to go back and correct this mistake from the 70s and make it clear that employers are required to accommodate the religious needs of its workforce in the same way that it provides religious accommodations for other employees.
So as I read the current interpretation of the law, if I, as a supervisor, have to go through the trouble of making out a new schedule for Sundays, that's enough inconvenience that we can ignore the command of Congress.
It's possible. Courts mm-hmm. have been very deferential to employers who simply say things like that. It's absurd when you look at these huge corporations, when you look at these huge agencies that could accommodate, but they just point to some minor inconvenience and say that that's enough to justify denying religious accommodation. You're not even trying.
It seems to me, in looking over a lot of these cases that Gina and I have seen for the past 6 or 7 years as we've been doing this program, is that there seems to be, I don't know if it's an animus or a reaction to religion or something is going on where religious accommodations and religious beliefs are really held at a very low standard. And it seems to me now from what I'm listening to what you're saying is that we probably have more cases like this out there where people are losing their jobs because a big company, I can understand a small mom and pop ice cream shop, you know, but big companies or the federal government, who has shown not to be friendly to religion lately, decide that it's just too inconvenient for them to do something and to accommodate these people's religious beliefs. So, fine, you go work someplace else.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if you just look at the language, so this undue hardship standard, it's used in other areas to provide protections for employees with disabilities. For example, Congress has recently had a bill to provide accommodations for pregnant employees and nursing employees, and they all use this undue hardship language, and it's given robust interpretations in all the other contexts except religion. So this is clearly an inconsistency where religion is being treated worse than the other than other employees and others in similar situations. And so we're excited about this opportunity for the Supreme Court to restore these protections.
Let me just, because I know we have to move on here because you've got another appointment, just to go back to this particular case, what will be the result if you lose the case for religious liberty in employment?
Well, it'll be continuing in this status quo, which has been religion has been given a second-class treatment compared to the other places where workplace accommodations are required. And so employers would be able to continue pointing to these minor inconveniences, these minimal burdens, to justify denying the religious accommodations that workers should be entitled to.
I think it's wonderful that Gerald Groff has offered to spend all this time and energy in an altruistic way to help society and those of people of faith. How is he doing? Is he in a good place now? Has he found some suitable employment? Is he a strong person and able to overcome some of the attacks because of this case?
Yes, absolutely. He's found an employer that respects his religious accommodation needs. And we are really honored to represent someone like Gerald. If more people were able to or had the courage and the conviction to stand up for their religious beliefs, we'd be in an entirely different society. And so he was willing to go through so much, to go through the months and months of progressive of discipline, of worrying if he's going to lose his job, of eventually being forced out of the post office, and then just taking on the sacrifices that come with litigation over the years to try to stand up for his rights and for the rights of other people who are in similar situations. So we're really honored to be able to represent Gerald.
And we're honored to have you here, and I know you have to leave in just a minute, but before you go, if somebody wants to follow this case or follow what First Liberty is doing, how do they contact you? What is the website there?
Absolutely. So they can follow this case by going to firstliberty.org, and there you can hear about this case and all of our other cases. Thank you so much for having me on the program to talk about this very important case. We hope we're anticipating we might receive a decision by the end of June.
Very good, very good. And I should point out that for those people who have some spare change that they want to put to a good cause, when you go to that website, you'll find a way to do that. Stephanie Taub, thank you very much for being with us today. Good luck on this case. God be with you. And we will talk to you again.
Thank you so much.
Certainly. We're going to take a break right now, and Gina and I will be back in just after these messages. All right, we're back. Gina and I now have with us Jordan Pratt, who is another attorney at First Liberty, who's handling another religious liberty case. Jordan, welcome to the program. I think this is the first time that we've had you on to Faith on Trial.
It is indeed. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. Good well, we always try and treat first-timers nicely so you'll come back.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
All right. You've got a case going on right now, a religious liberty case involving, I think it's a New York. New York is trying to inflict some, not penalties, but some requirements or regulations on houses of worship that it doesn't inflict on other people. So why don't we start at the very beginning, talk about where this case came from and what it stands for.
Sure. Well, I think to see where the case came from, you go back a couple of years during the COVID-19 crisis. New York had a couple of cases where by executive order, it had imposed, tighter restrictions on worship and other religious activities than what it was imposing on businesses. And there was a Supreme Court case called the Roman Catholic Diocese of New York against Cuomo. And that case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. That if you're going to be imposing restrictions on businesses and establishments, you can't single out houses of worship and place, in that case, I think it was occupancy restrictions. You can't say you can only have 20 people in a church, but you can have 200 people in a mall, right? Mm-hmm. So the Supreme Court held that that's a very clear violation of the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. Around that time, New York also had another case that was up at the Supreme Court that it likewise lost, and it was a Second Amendment case. And in that case, New York had, one of the most restrictive carry licensing regimes in the entire country. And what the Supreme Court held in the New York State Rifle Pistol Association case was that the state can't regulate firearms in a way that's out of step with our nation's historical traditions. And, the extremely restrictive licensing regime that New York had was a clear violation of the Second Amendment. So fast forward another year or two, and, just as we're coming off of the COVID crisis, what New York decided to do was to violate both rights at the same time in exactly the way that the Supreme Court said that it couldn't do, right? Which is kind of a bold strategy, I think, when you're coming off the heels of not one but two Supreme Court losses. And what New York did was it enacted a very comprehensive regime for the public carry of firearms. Now, of course, they're required to grant licenses because the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment requires the state of New York to do that. But what New York did was it turned around and listed, 26 different locations where it wasn't going to allow the carry of firearms. And it's a very restrictive, list. But it does allow secular businesses to decide whether to allow firearm carry on their property, right? So, you know, malls, salons, you know, local Radio Shack, Home Depot, you know, whatever. Those establishments, you know, the managers or the property owners there are allowed to decide for themselves whether patrons can carry their firearms. But New York singled out houses of worship and said that under no circumstances can someone carry in a house of worship. Even if the pastor, the priest, the rabbi wants to allow it, the landowner wants to allow it, doesn't matter. So it categorically disarmed places of worship. And essentially what New York said is you have to choose between your constitutional right to gather for worship and your constitutional right to armed self-defense, right? You have to forfeit one to enjoy the other. And I think it's just, it's unthinkable, frankly, that the state would do this, having lost, you know, both a First Amendment case and a Second Amendment case at the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court unequivocally held, you can't single out houses of worship for disfavored treatment. I would certainly say that disarming, categorically disarming houses of worship is disfavored treatment. You know, removing the exercise of a constitutional right categorically from houses of worship.
Okay.
That's certainly disfavored treatment.
Couple of things.
And then, of course.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
I was going
to
say.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, that's all right. I interrupt myself sometimes, so I'm not. That's fine. You're going up to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, correct?
That's correct. The district court agreed with our arguments and granted a preliminary injunction against the law, and the state has appealed that preliminary injunction to the Second Circuit.
Okay. All right. So that's where we're at right now. Now, this is kind of a funny case because we're talking about guns in churches, and it's something that doesn't seem to always go along together very well. Because I know there are a number of dioceses, for example, a number of other churches that have made their churches a gun-free zone. So let's go back to the need for this. Why would a clergyman want any of his parishioners to be able to carry, assuming they have the proper permit, in a church facility?
Right. So, and I think we recognize that congregations, parishes, synagogues may differ on the question, you know, what makes the most sense for them. But our client, his Tabernacle Family Church, and its pastor, Michael Spencer, believe that they are called by God to protect their congregation, that there are many references in Scripture that talk about, you know, a religious leader being like a shepherd of a flock. And, you know, our client, Pastor Spencer, takes that very seriously. And for him, he believes that that means providing not just for the religious needs of his congregation, but also for its physical needs, including its physical security. They have a security team composed of individuals who come from many different walks of life, some of whom have an incredible amount of firearms training, frankly.
And that's what you want if you have somebody that's a guard for your property. You want somebody who's been trained in firearms.
Yes, yes. And, you know, their church in particular, it's one of the largest congregations in that area of New York, and they regularly receive threats, including credible threats, that law enforcement have actually responded to, including one that was against Pastor Spencer himself, where members of the New York State Police, and remember the defendant in our case is the New York State Police. Well, officers of the New York State Police showed up. The pastor had been threatened with a firearm by an individual who it seems like was probably mentally disturbed. And they asked Pastor Spencer, do you have a firearm? He says, yes. And they said, that's a good idea. You should keep it. Right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we sued the New York State Police, and their own officers apparently share Pastor Spencer's judgment that it's advisable for him to carry a means of self-defense.
Well, that's something that we ought to point out here, because lately there's been a lot of violence against churches, against congregations, against religious organizations like pro-life centers. It seems to me when we should start this from a agreement that there is a need for protection of God's people, right?
Right. I agree.
And so
our client certainly agrees.
And so that when when the state or somebody else tries to step in and to water down or weaken that protection, that's something that we have to take seriously.
Well, I know that the Second Amendment rights are being, you know, there's a lot of states and legislatures watching what's going on with New York as they try to limit arms possessions in their state, because I'm sure there, I know that there are other legislatures and communities that would like to do the same thing. But at the same time, I understand that, you know, there was a case a couple of years ago, maybe in Texas, with an armed parishioner had literally saved the church from someone who meant to do harm against mm-hmm. them with a firearm.
That's right.
And
yes, there's a Church of Christ in. Oh, I'm sorry. That incident actually features in our briefing. You know, the contrast, I think you're exactly right. There have been a lot of, you know, incidents, high profile incidents of houses of worship. And what made that one different was that it was, you know, that a parishioner was ready and capable of stopping the threat. And in fact, I think stopped the threat within 5 seconds of the first shot going right. off. Sadly, I think there were two casualties, but, you know, Lord only knows what would have happened if they had not had a security team in place that was ready to respond.
But that action,
that's something that
that action in the state of New York right now would be criminalized.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, wait, there's an injunction, right? So it's not criminal right at this point.
Well, if the law was allowed to go into effect, yeah.
That's right.
It would be. Right.
If the law were not enjoined, the law would criminalize any act of armed self-defense at a church. And what's really baffling about this is, you know, this. Our client agrees that houses of worship with the state, houses of worship are vulnerable to attack, to violence. But what the state of New York has chosen to do, right, I think it's pretty indisputable that there have been some high-profile incidents. What the state of New York has chosen to do is to say, you know, we're going to require churches to disarm completely, right? And none of these incidents, you know, have churches dealt with a member, you know, much less a member of a security team who's licensed and trained, you know, committing an act of violence against the congregation. It's always an outsider. So what New York is doing is it's stacking the deck in favor of the outsider who wants to come in and do harm, right? I think
exactly.
The Texas incident shows what happens when a church, when a congregation is prepared to protect its flock. And that incident went very differently from how the other ones have gone. And the state of New York is simply exacerbating the problem that it admits, right? The state of New York admits, hey, you are vulnerable to violence. You can be victimized. Now we're going to take from you your means of self-defense. Doesn't seem like a very logical way of responding to the problem.
Yeah,
especially when they're talking about defunding the police.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. I hate to sound, you know, pro-gun, but it seems to me that there's a real problem when we talk about these gun-free zones, and we set up the people that are in them as targets. Anybody who wants to go into a place knowing there's not going to be somebody there with a weapon that can stop them. Put some mm-hmm. more at risk. And like I say, I'm not a big gun advocate. I do own a gun. I do own a pistol, a little 38 caliber snub nose, which I can hit the side of a barn at 7 yards. That's about as good as I can do with that. But we don't want to leave people unprotected. And it seems to me that when you say that the churches can't have armed security, in a time when there's a lot of violence directed toward the churches, you're just compounding the problem there for the churches and their people.
Right. And I think the overall message is, look, different religious bodies are going to have, you know, different opinions about this and what they should do. Hmm. And that's fine. New York allows that discretion for any other any secular establishment, right? If you go to Home Depot, right, the management there, the ownership there can decide. They can decide whether they're going to, you know, allow visitors, patrons, employees to carry, right? If you go to, you know, the hair salon down the street, if you go to the Dunkin' Donuts, right? But when you go to a church, what New York has said is we are going to remove that discretion from you. We are not going to allow you to make that determination. And that, I think, just smacks of, you know, frankly, I don't know any other way to say it, targeting of religious people, right? This is what New York was doing during the COVID emergency.
Well, it's what a lot of people were doing during the COVID emergency. They were targeting religious facilities.
That's right. And this is sort of a carryover of that. I thought we had learned that lesson, right? The Supreme Court was very clear that the basic guarantee of the Free Exercise Clause, it may guarantee more than this, but at its core, it at least guarantees the right to equal treatment. And you can't, you know, target a religious body for disfavored treatment, and that's exactly what this law does. So even if you ignore the Second Amendment problem, we've got a giant free exercise problem.
Gina, you had something?
Jordan, how confident are you if this keeps percolating up through the system and the Supreme Court again rules that New York is out of line, that New York won't come up with yet another way to target religious institutions or people who want their Second Amendment rights enacted?
Well, it does seem like the political leadership for the time being is bent on wasting taxpayer dollars on actions that I think pretty clearly contravene Supreme Court precedent. But at some point, I think the voters stand up and say, stop wasting our money. And I think I would hope that we would get to that point, you know, if and when we're willing to take this case to the Supreme Court if we have to. Hopefully the Second Circuit does the right thing and affirms. If not, I believe we would definitely have the energy and the resources and the will to take this all the way. But I think New York really does need to start getting the message, right? You can't single out religious bodies for disfavored treatment, right? And, you know, on the Second Amendment side, we have a right to arms, both to keep and to bear arms. And the state needs to stop resisting the clear mandates of the Supreme Court, and it needs to abide by its judgment. It may disagree. I understand that. But when the Supreme Court has spoken, that is the final arbiter of federal law in our system, and the state needs to respect it. And if it doesn't, it just equates to a massive waste of taxpayer dollars and a type of defiance that I don't think is good for the fabric of our society. You know, we need to respect the judgment of the Supreme Court.
It seems to me that you have precedent, legal precedent on your side on this, but it also seems to me that you're fighting against a wave of anti-religious animus that is coming at you, and this is just part of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know the heart, especially when you're talking about a legislature that's composed of, you know, hundreds of individuals. But there does seem to be a high number of cases that involve both, you know, free exercise and religious rights claims and Second Amendment claims that come out of New York. I wouldn't presume to know the motivations, but I do know the effect. The effect is that the legislature continues to enact policies that infringe the fundamental liberties of its citizens, both its First and Second Amendment rights. And it's doing so in ways that I think are not justifiable under Supreme Court precedent. So I think hopefully New York will get the message and stop its waste of taxpayer dollars. But I guess we'll just have to see what happens.
Yeah, you have to see. It's the end of March, I think, you're arguing that case. Yeah, March 20th.
That's right.
Notes that I have. Right. Are there similar cases percolating around the country that deal with churches being singled out for something?
No, and that's one thing that I forgot to address. New York so far stands alone in the nation. Even in jurisdictions that have some pretty restrictive carry regimes, none of them does something like what New York has done. New York gives discretion to most business owners, but when it comes to, you know, religious leaders, it removes that discretion from them and categorically requires disarmament. And that is a lone outlier policy in the nation. If you go back to the founding of our country, actually, there were several colonies that then became states, which required by law the male members of a congregation to keep their firearms with them during services, and not even to deposit them at the front of the church, but to actually carry the firearms with them to the pew. I think it was a readiness measure, right, to be ready to respond militarily should the need arise. But, you know, when you talk about our nation's, you know, history of firearm regulation, The only examples that we can find that actually call out, you know, religious bodies specifically, they enacted exactly the opposite policy. They required firearm carry as a means, presumably, to protect the congregation and to protect the Commonwealth. And what New York has done is just so far out of step with our nation's history and tradition, you know, both with regard to free exercise rights and with regard to Second Amendment rights, that it's just it's quite unjustifiable. And even in modern times, it's a lone outlier. So we'll see if any jurisdictions choose to enact a similar policy. If they did, I think it would be very vulnerable to challenge for all of the same reasons that New York's, you know, policy is. And, you know, if you become aware of another jurisdiction that's doing that, please let us know, because that's a cause that I'm sure that we would also be willing to take up.
Yeah, you seem to have First Liberty especially seems to have a lot on its plate right now. And I'll ask you the same thing I asked Stephanie. If somebody wants to follow what you are doing, how do they contact First Liberty? What is the website? And I take mm-hmm. it there's also a place there for those who want to make a donation, because what you do is pro bono. The clients don't pay anything. And so
that's correct.
You deserve some financial support. So what is the First Liberty address, and how do they get a hold of that?
Yeah. Sure. Folks can go to firstliberty.org, and in addition to, you know, a portal for folks who want to support our work, whether through prayer or through donations, we also, for folks who have a legal question or a legal problem, they can submit what's called a request for legal help through our website, and we look at all of those. And, you know, as you mentioned, all of the legal services that we provide are free to our clients. That's, you know, critical to what we do. We don't want our clients to have to pay a dime just to vindicate their basic right to live according to their faith. So that's how we operate. And if anybody wants to learn more, they can go to firstliberty.org.
Very, very good. Thank you very much. We're pretty much out of time right now, but we appreciate you joining us today. And we wish you luck in this case and all the other cases that you have. We're certainly praying for you, and we wish you well. So, Jordan Pratt,
thank you so
for
much.
Joining us today. Appreciate it. And Gene and I will be right back after these messages. And we are back. You're listening to Faith on Trial on the Iowa Catholic Radio Network. Gene, an interesting couple of cases today, both from the same place, First Liberty. And they present interesting issues that we need to deal with.
Well, I'll tell you what, the First Liberty Institute website is chocked full of crazy cases, things that you would imagine wouldn't be an issue under the First Amendment and the Second Amendment and religious liberties that have been allowed in this country for hundreds of years. So the first case we dealt with was a postal worker who asked for accommodations to not work on Sunday. Since when do we force people to work on Sundays as a country?
Yeah, it was always my understanding that the only way you could avoid that is if it would require undue hardship on for the employer. So, for example, a mom-and-pop candy store that was in a mall that had somebody working there, it couldn't order them to they could be excused from not abiding by that, because obviously if there's only two or three people that are employees, they need them all and they need them to be able to rotate and whatever. But when you're talking about an institution as large as the Postal Service, you're talking about something that it's very hard to see where one guy who's been there for a number of years and says, well, I don't want to work on Sunday because now you have a Sunday carrier that we've got to do. Get somebody else to it. Why that is such a hardship for them? I mean, the postal workers, you know, they could sign up for overtime. They can sign up for all sorts of things. A lot of people, I'm sure, would pick up the extra hours. That doesn't seem to me to be much of a hardship for them.
Well, between that case and listening to all the rejections of the religious objections to the vaccine, it seems to me that it's just another situation where an employer has some bias against people of faith.
Yeah, yeah. And the second case you know, it's kind of odd to have a religious liberty case revolve around Second Amendment rights. But that's exactly what this is, and it's a valid argument to make. I mean, let the churches decide themselves if they want to have armed security in their facilities or not.
Well, I know New York is doing everything they can, both on a state level and in the city of New York itself, to limit citizens' rights to arms. And why not just throw in the religious institutions in there anyway? Because we've seen over the past 2 or 3 years how targeted those these religious places of worship have been in both the state and the city mm-hmm. of New York. I love that both, the casual disregard for constitutional amendments by the state and city of New York, it amazes me that there isn't some kind of backlash for that just blatant disregard for our rights.
Yeah. But you get the government that you vote for. And so that's what they have.
Right. I know that the city of Chicago is, and maybe not the state of Illinois, but definitely the city of Chicago is watching with real anticipation to how New York ends up landing on these issues from a legal standpoint.
Yeah. I wouldn't eliminate the state of Illinois on that either, because I think the governor that they have there right now is doing many of the same things.
I love a little historical fact at the very end. I wondered if you would ever come across that in all that you read and the history that you follow, that churches required you to bring your arms.
I can understand that.
I can
understand that considering the time. Anyway, I did want to talk about one other thing here, and that's Mark Houck. And we've talked about Mark Houck before. We had on one of his attorneys, Peter Breen, just a couple of weeks ago talking about the case. On Monday, for those who don't remember what was going on, he was accused of violating what they call the FACE law, the law that requires you to provide or not to block entrances to an abortion clinic. The facts of the case were kind of sketchy, but yet showed very appropriately that he was not doing that. And it was something that was anticipated by everybody, even the witnesses. But it was interesting that the Department of Justice wanted to pursue that case anyway. And they not only pursued it, they staged a raid on this man's house with FBI agents, about 24 FBI agents there with loaded guns, long guns, a battering ram, and they were
early in the morning, took
the guy away, even though they knew what the facts were. And yet it took the jury in the Houck case in Philadelphia, go Eagles, by the way, and to acquit him of both charges. He was facing 11 years in prison, and the federal government was still prosecuting him. And it's interesting because there are a number of other cases around the country where the government and the Justice Department are being weaponized against people of faith. And we're going to try and have somebody on next week and talk about that in a little bit.
And this is a good win and a good precedent for people who pray outside of abortion.
Oh, yeah, it certainly is. It certainly is. And thanks
because
to the Thomas.
Because if he had lost, that would have been a very difficult decision.
Yeah, and that's what Peter Breen said right after that. And that was the Thomas More Law Society, or the Thomas More Society, I guess they call it, that took care of all of the defense there. So we appreciate that. All right, it's about time that we end with our defender's prayer. St. Michael the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray, and do thou, O Prince of the Heavenly Host, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all the evil spirits who prowl about the world seeking the ruin of souls. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you to our guests, to Jimmy Olson, who's running our board. And from Gina and me, thank you for listening. And we'll be back again next week with another edition of Faith on Trial. Till then, have a blessed and peaceful week.
Our freedom of conscience and religion is being challenged by laws and regulations imposed by secular society. Faith on Trial with Defender of the Faith, Deacon Mike Mano. Faith on Trial on Iowa Catholic Radio, iowacatholicradio.com, and the Iowa Catholic Radio app.